Thank you all for coming to this dimly lit and impressively resplendent ballroom to talk about classical rhetoric and the modern web. Thank you. That was our first woo. I am Matt Moraine. I'm a PhD candidate at NC State, finishing up my dissertation on memes and rhetoric, and I'll be presenting here with Quinn Warnick to my left, who's an assistant professor right here at St. Ed's, and Jeff Swift all the way to the left, who's in my program as well. And we're sort of put this panel together to talk about the theories that we have studied for a good amount of time that we see that are quite applicable to this conversation, and to give you a sense of what you may be missing by not studying rhetoric, and you'll probably find that a lot of what you already know is just called rhetoric by a different name. And so our panel today is going to be a little bit different in format. Rather than kind of just bandy about with witty, hilarious discussion up here, we're going to each take turns with a kind of short, brief presentation to introduce our concepts of classical Greek things like ethos, demagoguery, and kairos to give you all sort of a base of what we're dealing with here, and then we'll open it up to discussion and questions after that. So really looking forward to hearing what you all have to say. And we changed our hashtag from whatever the bulky one was from before to just S by or South by rhetoric. So go by that, and we will see you all on the onlines. So we're going to start with Jeff over there, who's going to teach us a little bit about rhetoric online and demagoguery. Take it away, Jeff.
All right. Thanks, Matt. Closer. All right. Is this... Okay, perfect. Okay, so the motivating question behind a lot of the research that I do is how deliberation, debate, and discussion, dialogue happens online, and how we can make it happen better, how it can be more effective. So in order to get at this question, one angle that I'm going to focus on is the classical understanding of rhetoric. I'm just going to start with that. So rhetoric is concerned, as Aristotle said, with what seems probable. It's not science, which is concerned with what is observable. It's not religion, which is concerned with what is eternal or true. It's not politics, concerned with what is, I don't know, broken or whatever, I don't know. But this rhetoric is, in classical understanding, rhetoric is concerned with what is probable. So because of that, it leads into this understanding of demagoguery. And the popular understanding of demagoguery is simply basically just an overly biased argument, right? It's if an argument is too one-sided, too dishonest, too hateful, then you've got a demagogue on your hands. This mountainous problem is more than a rhetorical molehill, and it's ancient Greek rhetoricians were very worried about this. They took this very seriously, and so should we, especially since in our day, demagogues are much more tech-savvy. And they're armed with something quite prevalent online today, which is the myth of neutrality. So to summarize what the rest of this presentation is going to look like, I'm going to kind of talk about the myth of neutrality, this idea that demagoguery is pretending to be neutral when that's impossible. So in other words, it's not the bias that qualifies something as demagoguery, but the manipulative masking of that bias. So in this presentation, I'm going to describe a study comparing internet link aggregation sites reddit.com and realclearpolitics.com. The aim of this study was to compare these two sites to expose any trends that could help move forward our understanding of demagoguery. Neither site really qualifies as a demagogue in the popular sense of the term. They both... they're open to the other side, and they're open to disagreement. So for this study, what I did is I took 10 days and the top 10 links every day on Reddit and the top 10 links on Real Clear Politics. Both of these are link aggregation websites focusing on politics. So I took these and I looked at the partisanship and whether the people who posted the links... whether the people who posted the links changed the link title at all. A lot of times the article would say one thing and the link would say something entirely different. So from political rhetorician Brian Garston, the issue of demagoguery is not so much tied to hateful arguments or biased speakers as it's tied to the idea of deliberation. The problem with demagoguery is not found in what he calls messy public discourse. Passionate disagreement is key to his understanding of rhetoric. Rather, demagoguery happens when a rhetor or an orator hijacks the discussion through manipulation or pandering. The problem created by this is not bias or ideological inflammation. The problem is that demagogues hide their own bias behind a veneer of neutrality, creating what I call the bobblehead audience. And this is particularly troubling in the digital age, where we should have access to a lot of different viewpoints, and we should have robust disagreement and be able to have a clash of ideas that's very productive. Demagogues, however, interfere with the process, and the resulting bobblehead audience is more polarized than it would have been otherwise. Not only do they not engage with anyone else, but they don't even know that there's anyone else to engage with. In the digital age, the problem is that the public sphere is becoming less public than we had hoped. The digital public sphere has become gerrymandered into hundreds of digital cliques, echo chambers where people listen only to arguments with which they already agree. While it's always been possible to completely ignore opposing arguments, the digital age has made it pretty easy to do that. And the problem with this type of demagoguery is that hiding underlying biases, which are unavoidable, since we're humans, stifles deliberation by claiming that unbiased neutrality for one position. And if you don't agree with the unbiased truth, then you're just insane, right? So there's only reason to believe the people who claim to be unbiased. So in order to explore practical occurrences of this, I'm looking at Real Clear Politics and Reddit. And just a quick summary of each one. Real Clear Politics is institutionally driven. There's editors who select, they curate this front page that links out to a number of different sources every day. Reddit, on the other hand, the politics subreddit, is community-driven. Individuals post links, and then they're upvoted. And so the most popular links make it to the top. They float to the top in the front page. So on the one hand, you've got institutions. On the other hand, you've got a kind of a community, editors versus upvoters. And these are both very popular websites. They're both very well-respected. So one of Reddit's rules, which is written... One of our Real Clear Politics rules is that they promise to cover all aspects of the U.S. political process from a wide range of ideological perspectives. So this seemed like the perfect type of non-demagogic website. They talk about everything, and they have a wide range of ideological perspectives, therefore hopefully avoiding manipulation and pandering and getting to good quality deliberation online. Reddit, on the other hand, doesn't have a lot of rules concerning what they put up there. Like I said, it's community-driven. Instead, they ask their users to not editorialize the links. So they're not going to end up spouting your own opinion. What a lot of Reddit users end up doing is copying the most interesting sentence or two from the article itself and posting that as the article title. That still falls in line with the Reddit rules. The interesting thing that I found was that Reddit and Real Clear Politics both change the titles significantly. Like I said, Reddit usually doesn't post the name of the actual New York Times article. They post the most interesting tidbit. On Real Clear Politics, they just make tweaks here and there. And there's nowhere on their site where it explains why they're making these tweaks or how or what the process is. They'll take out a word, or they'll add in a couple of words, or they'll rephrase it completely, or they will just kind of do any of these little things that you wouldn't notice if you just looked on the front page every day. So there were some other patterns that became noticeable over the course of this study. Reddit posts are most often about social policy and campaigns and elections, economics. It's clear that these are the things that they care about. There's a pretty good range of things on this politics subreddit. On the other hand, the Real Clear Politics is almost entirely about campaigns and elections and economics. There's nothing about social policy. this is quite interesting when you think back to what they promised, which is all the major issues of the day. During the time frame that I collected this data, there was the big hubbub about the man in Georgia who was executed, and Reddit posted dozens of links about this particular person, Troy Davis, and there was not a single link on Real Quick Politics. So they claim to talk about all aspects of the day, and it turns out they miss some. Another really interesting comparison is the difference between link title changes from partisan sources on Real Clear Politics and Reddit. So the way I coded these is anything that was overtly liberal, I just put it blue. Anything that was overtly conservative, I had it be red. And then there was most of the links in the middle were just somewhere in the middle. They weren't. So I put the New York Times and the Washington Post and the things like that in the middle. And then anything that said, we are overtly, you know, this is a liberal website, and we talk about liberal links, I put that on liberal. So I tried to be fair with how I divided these up. So Real Clear Politics changes almost everybody exactly the same. They make their tweaks across the board. Reddit mostly changes the liberal links that they put up, which makes sense. It's more of a liberal-ish group, and so they're more interested in the left arguments. So they'll take the most interesting thing. They're more interested in changing the titles of the liberal things. Again, Real Clear Politics claims to have a wide range of ideological perspectives, and you can see that 62.7% of their links go to somewhere in the middle, 32.2% go to right-wing sources, and then a sliver, it's about 5%, go to liberal sources. So their wide range goes from very far right to somewhere in the middle, with a little tiny bit on the left. Reddit is about the same, except for opposite. Mostly somewhere in the middle, with a big chunk going to left-wing sources, and then a little bit in the middle. A little bit on the right. So the interesting thing about this is they're both exactly the same, about, but just on opposite sides of the spectrum. But one claims to show a wide range of ideological perspectives, and the other one says, post whatever you want, and people will upvote it. So there's a pretty significant difference there. And the difference is that, like I said, the one side masks what they're doing and hides their bias, and the other side just says, yeah, we're biased, and if you don't like it, go somewhere else. So there's this difference gets at the core of the classical understanding of the demagogue. And I think it's really important for today because online there's a lot of opinions going around. There's a lot of different news sources and a lot of different debate sites and a lot of different ideas going around there. And rhetorically, if we look at these websites as masking their bias, that helps us understand what they're doing. And it helps us see, okay, that everyone has a bias, right? There's no way you cannot have a dog in the fight. If you enter the discussion, you've got a dog in the fight. So you can't pretend like somehow you're standing aloof and that you are not a part of, you know, the human race as we talk about these things. You can't just take a step back. So demagoguery is really important in online discussion and in online debate because you can't get around bias. If you pretend that you do, then you're a demagogue. You're a digital demagogue. Thank you.
Thanks, Jeff. I'm going to go ahead and switch to our next one now because that clown is terrifying the hell out of me as a coulrophobe. So we'll go back to Steve Jobs, which makes it slightly less terrifying. And we'll move on then from demagoguery to talking about ethos with Quinn Warnick here to lead us through part two.
Hi, I'm Quinn Warnick. I'm an assistant professor here in St. Edward's University right here in Austin, Texas. Although my job title will be changing very shortly, I'm in my last couple of months at St. Ed's and will be headed to Virginia Tech this fall. Today I want to talk to you about three definitions, one website, and four paradoxes that can help us understand a greatly and deeply troubled word. See, we all know what this is, right? Very simple. Well, it comes to us in English as ethos. And ethos is a word that has had so many definitions over the years that it has completely lost its origins and its roots. Its popular definitions range from anything like essence, credibility, personality, character. We talk about the ethos of a company or whether or not someone has ethos. But then academic definitions complicate this even further, where we get into very specific and very arcane historical definitions about ethos as a habitat or a place or a custom. When we, as academics, teach the concept of ethos to undergraduate students, and some of you may remember this from your freshman composition class, you can nod along if this sounds anything familiar, we often go back to Aristotle's rhetoric. And our students, of course, and sometimes us too, we ignore what Aristotle actually says. And the students may have great reason for doing so, given how simplistic Aristotle's definition is. So today I want to complicate this a little bit by talking about three different aspects of ethos, or three different varieties of ethos. So the first one, Isocrates, who actually predates Aristotle by several hundred years, says, "The man who wishes to persuade people will not be negligent as to the matter of character. No, on the contrary, he will apply himself above all to establish a most honorable name among his fellow citizens," etc., etc. And he says, "The argument which is made by a man's life is more weight than that which is furnished by his words." Notice here that the emphasis rests on the speaker's actions, not his words. Isocrates makes it clear that the efficacy of a speaker's words will be greater if the speaker is of good repute. So even though Isocrates predates Aristotle, his ideas find their greatest proponents in Rome several centuries later. So here's Quintilian, who says that eloquence requires the speaker to be a man of good character and pleasing manners. And if a man speaks and is thought to be a bad man, he must certainly speak ineffectively, for he will not be thought to speak sincerely. If he did, his ethos or his character would appear. So Quintilian argues that orators must not only speak well, but they have to act well. This is the good man whose arguments will be bolstered by his own excellent qualities. This is the notion of the vir bonus, or the good man speaking well. Of course, along came the internet, which was supposed to kill the notion of the vir bonus. In other words, this is supposed to detach the idea of a man's speech from the speech, from his actions outside of the speech. And this is reflected in pages like this on Wikipedia, where users are taught to ignore all credentials of users. So it actually says, if you have academic credentials, you can't use them to settle arguments. You can't say, well, I have a PhD, or I'm an expert in this, or I've published a book. You have to point directly to written sources. In other words, your character, your lived experience is distinct from the text that you're writing. So perhaps we're back to square one, and that takes us to the second definition, which again is Aristotle's original definition, where he says that persuasion should be achieved by what the speaker says, not by what people think of his character before he begins to speak. So maybe ethos really is generated by the text that we speak, or in today's age, the words that we type into an online forum, for instance. For Aristotle, the pisteis, or the proofs, are elements of the text, and their effectiveness depends upon the careful construction of the speech, not on the personal attributes of the speaker. So this is ethos as a textual element, and it's internal to the discourse itself. Reputation and credibility is not connected to who said it or what their background is, what they've done in their personal life. It's how good the argument is on its face. But there's a third definition of ethos that we don't think about very much and that I want to make sure that we don't forget. Thomas W. Benson, a rhetorical scholar, claims that Aristotle's notion of ethos as a mode of proof presupposes earlier concepts of ethos as dwelling place. In other words, he's saying that Aristotle has shifted our definition of ethos, but that's not the real definition. We go back several hundred years earlier, and Michael Halloran here is arguing that ethos is a collective, not an individual attribute. This is the notion of ethos as gathering place, something that we build collectively in an online community, for instance. That's where my research lies. Why does this definition of ethos matter? Well, I think it matters because of numbers like this one. According to the Pew Internet and American Life Project, 22% of online Americans regularly post comments to a news group, a forum, or blog. And if we translate that with the math, we get about 39 million people participating in these online videos. That's just here in the United States. We're not even talking internationally. So how big is the internet? A few years ago, two software engineers at Google updated the official Google weblog with a momentous piece of news. The company's archived index of unique URLs had just passed the 1 trillion mark. How big is a trillion? The engineers tried to put it into perspective. Multiple times every day, we do the computational equivalent of fully exploring every intersection of every road in the United States, except it would be a map about 50,000 times as big as the U.S. with 50,000 times as many roads and intersections. So how in the world do we make sense of so many gathering places? My answer is we've got to do it one website at a time. So that's what I do. I study online communities. And today I want to talk about one website in particular, one community, metafilter.com. Any Mephites in the audience, past, present, or future? Hooray. Yay. For a few of you. Yay. For those of you who aren't familiar with Metafilter, it is one of the longest-running group weblogs online, and it is widely praised in the media as one of the few places where you can go to find sensible, accommodating, actually helpful discussion. Gary Marshall on TechRadar calls it a banquet for the brain. This is kind of the anti-YouTube comments area. It's the opposite of that. Okay. So I spent a year studying Metafilter, and they've got 49,000 user accounts at the time, 238,000 discussion threads, 5 million comments, and 16 million rows in their database, and that's just over a one-year period. So how do you make sense of that much data? Well, first you've got to take a snapshot of it. You've got to decide, like Jeff, I'm going to look at 10 days' worth. In my case, this was a much longer, kind of a year-long ethnography, which captured 4 months of actual threads and discussions. And then you use a multi-method approach, where you're not just looking at the text itself, but you've got to go and do some member checking. So you've got to talk to the people who participate and say, hey, here's what I think you were saying. Is that actually what was happening here? So I did surveys, interviews with the moderators, downloaded the entire database, and ran some numbers on it as well, and also tried to narrow my focus a little bit, so we're focusing on just one part of the site. There's a subsection of the site called MetaTalk, which is kind of a second sub-area that allows members of the community to do self-policing and self-moderation. So this is a place where people come to call out other users for bad behavior on the main portion of the site, to ask for changes to how the site functions, to report bugs, to praise other users, to thank people. So when I asked the members of Metafilter what MetaTalk was like, they gave me several different answers. And I like the analogies that they use to describe this. Some of them said it's like the core members of a debate team getting together after a meet in a bar somewhere to hash out what they did well, what they did poorly, to accuse their teammates of unsportsmanlike conduct. Someone says it's a place where you can walk around without your pants. Someone else calls it the police blotter of the site. MetaTalk is like the House of Lords. It's not as well known, but has much more dark humor components. Someone else says it's like the lunch table at work. People aren't fully removed from business, but they're a bit less inhibited. Someone else calls it a drama safari where the animals attack the tour bus and the ground is strewn with blood and cartilage. So it can be an ugly place as well. This is not just a place of high-minded discourse, but it is a place where it is rhetoric distilled. I like to think of MetaTalk as a place where when you talk about rhetoric and discourse, this is where it's happening, where people are solving problems and arguing out site policy and determining who they are as a community using their words. Okay. Someone calls it the back alley behind the bar, and one of my favorites, of course, as a rhetorician, someone spontaneously called it sort of a gathering place where we can come. Okay. So for a year, I focused on MetaTalk, and I could show you pretty charts that break down the 43,000 posts and 1 million comments made by 14,000 users. We could talk about how MetaTalk posts are categorized on the site, or the average number of comments per post, or the length of the comments. I could talk about the long tail effect and how it relates to user participation. I'll just point out very quickly that those two tiny thin bars on the far left of the chart are the two of the moderators of the site who play a much larger role in this subsection of the site than any other user. We could talk about the varying levels of moderator participation on the different subsites. I could carefully explain the 12 rhetorical functions that I identified in users' posts on MetaTalk. Trust me, this discussion would be fascinating. Just ask my dissertation committee. But I would rather tell you a story about Svetlana and Ksenia, two Russian students who came to the United States for what they thought were summer jobs. Daniel Reintz is a 28-year-old North Dakota blogger who was traveling to California for a new job. He is a member of the Metafilter community, and he goes by the username Fake, which is a great username when you're talking about online identity and anonymity and trust. And this is a terrible admission here, but Matt forced me to change my setup to a place where I can't even read my own notes. So I'm going to tweak this here for just a second.
This is what we like to call the soft shoe approach to changing things as we go. And in the meantime, I'd like to sing you all a song from my native homeland. Oh, my homeland people are silent. Isn't it beautiful?
Okay. Much better for me.
And we're back.
No, not better for me. Come on. Shouldn't let you do that, Matt.
You shouldn't have. I'm a bully when it comes to that. Get some water, Jeff.
There we go. Okay. So here's what's happening. He's on his way to California for a new job, and he posts a link to Ask Metafilter, which is a Q&A discussion portion of the site. He says, a Russian friend of mine may be in a dangerous situation in Washington, D.C. They arrived yesterday with a friend. They came over on some kind of travel exchange program, and the XXX is the name of that program that's been crossed out. They paid about $3,000 for the program. The program promised a job offer in advance, but it didn't deliver. They said they'd send one by email, but they failed there too, and her contact barely speaks English. And here's he's asked her and a friend to meet in New York City tonight around midnight with the promises of hostess work in a lounge. Yes, I know how horrific that sounds. That's why I'm working all the angles here. She's not going to NYC, but I need some help handling and understanding how to handle this. I have a friend helping them with a cheap hotel for the night, but that's all at the moment. I'm presently driving to L.A., blah, blah, blah. I'm going to be monitoring this over the next few hours. So immediately someone chimes in within a few minutes. She should contact her consulate. And fake responds from his phone, as in the Russian consulate. Can you help me find the information? Somebody else comes in and says, here's the information. So the community springs into action with just a matter of minutes on a situation like this. Someone else comes in. I live in D.C. Let me know if you need help from someone here. I don't really know about human trafficking scams or anything like that. But if I can be of help in any way, email me, which is the internal contact system on the site. Someone else says, I live in D.C. They come in and second that, offering another place to stay. Fake, the original poster, comes back and says, the problem is I can't convince them, so I'm now trying to find some other means of protection or prevention. I'm really desperate here. The place they've been promised a job is a place called Lux Lounge, which I doubt exists. And the minute this happens, the detectives on Metafilter spring into action. So someone else offers another place to stay. And then a user named Schmod comes in and says, here's the place, and posts a link to the Google Maps. It was some kind of Russian restaurant. And then on and on, at the very bottom there's other tidbits indicating that it operates as a strip joint. Someone else comes in and says, the physical address doesn't verify on Google Street View. And another person comes in and says, to people who are still saying this might be an honest job offer, I've studied human trafficking. So contrast this with the Wikipedia ignore all credentials, right? So someone comes in now and says, I've studied human trafficking and other forms of forced migration under a professor who specializes in this. This is literally quite literally a textbook case of women being trafficked into the sex industry. Someone else comes in, for future reference in situations exactly like this, please contact the U.S. State Department at jsvisas@state.gov. We, and by that I mean my coworkers and I, will get this situation rectified immediately upon learning of such situations. So what are the chances that someone who works in for the State Department on human trafficking just happens to be a member of this online community? Who is it? Yeah, and the username is Poyo Macho, right? So we're seeing all sorts of wonderful paradoxes and contradictions here. A member of the site convinced them to meet her instead of the contact, and then here's fake saying, I think she is cool, right? Because he doesn't know who has offered to help them out, but he knows that anyone on Metafilter is better than the guys at the Lux Lounge, right? And he's willing to trust the people in his online community. Someone else says, wonderful news. Anybody following this? This is a nice little side note. Anybody who's following this, who's on the route between Salt Lake City, Vegas, and Southern California, in the Meta thread, which is the Meta Talk thread, there's some effort to find fake a place to take a break from driving. Ah, right? The community all banding together to not only help these girls, but to help the guy who's worried about them. And so then Internet Fraud Detective Squad, fantastic name, is Catherine Gutierrez-Hines. She's a 24-year-old psychology student living in Brooklyn, and she says, I have them. Everything's good. And if anybody's in Brooklyn, here's my phone number, right? So while this is happening, there's a MetaTalk thread that's being posted called The Kindness of Strangers, where the community kind of reflects upon what has happened over in the Ask MetaFilter thread. Internet Fraud Detective Squad says, I just emailed the police and Jessamine. The cops funded some dinner, so we're good for tonight, et cetera, et cetera. Totally made my day when we saw about 20 nuns in full habits wandering around the Port Authority. I have copied a few of the moderators so they can give you any information you need. And then here's my favorite thing that kind of sums it all up. So tomorrow, if anyone at work asks me what I did last night, I'll say, I didn't do a thing, but a website where I regularly post links about comic books and toy soldiers saved a couple women from being victims of an international sex trafficking ring. I'm not sure how I'm going to explain that. The story gets picked up by Boing Boing, and then they're profiled a much longer format in Mother Jones and eventually in Newsweek as well. And 3 weeks later, Fake posts writes a follow-up post letting everyone know that the girls are okay. They're back in Russia. They're safe and sound. The community responds with another 254 comments of congratulations and praise. Stories like this one illustrate why MetaFilter is such a rich venue for research. They also point to some of the complexities of the site that can't really be explained with charts or graphs. And over the course of my study, I regularly ran up against the limitations of my formal research methods. And it was at these moments that I began to notice what I've taken to calling the paradoxes of MetaFilter. So here are four quick things to think about as I conclude. First, ethos resides in the text, except when it doesn't. Popular depictions of online communities paint them as disembodied spaces where users are known only by their internet nicknames and cartoon avatars, but my study suggests that contemporary online communities regularly cross into the physical space and that individual ethos is as much a function of one's identity outside the online community as it is a function of one's rhetorical skills within the online community. Second, collective ethos is the work of a few. As a longtime reader of MetaFilter, I knew that not all the members of the community participated in MetaTalk, but I was surprised to discover just how small the core community is. Just a few hundred users account for well over half the comments made on MetaTalk, and yet these discussions set the tone for the rest of the site and help shape the policies that affect nearly 50,000 members of the community. Third, the best dictators have no rules. The owner of MetaFilter's man named Matt Howie is often described by members of the community as a benevolent dictator with a laissez-faire ethic. And when asked, Howie himself described his leadership style as a loosey-goosey guideline approach. He advises online community managers to not make a bunch of strict rules because once you go down that path of even a few rules, you'll soon find yourself at the top of a heap of laws that constantly have to be added to in order to please your most argumentative members, while at the same time having those rules hold you back and force you to bring the hammer down on people that accidentally crossed a line. Fourth and finally, serious communities are powered by silliness. During my years as a dedicated lurker on MetaTalk, I was often impressed by how effectively members of the community argued with one another. And as a student of online communication, I saw these highly nuanced conversations that were ripe for rhetorical analysis. The moment I put my researcher's hat on, the sophisticated conversations seemed to evaporate, and in their place, I mostly saw immature jokes, ceaseless puns, and frequent name-calling. And what had happened to my perfect research site? The answer, of course, is that the jokes had been there all along. As a member of the community, I just stopped noticing what Albert Roussy calls the ludic discourse or the playful discourse that surrounds the serious work of the community. This happens in offline communities as well, right? Every workplace has a water cooler or a lunchroom or a back alley behind the bar where things get a little bit nasty sometimes or a little bit silly. Why does all this matter to teachers and researchers of rhetoric and composition like me? Why should all this matter to people like you? Well, Howard Rheingold reminds us that virtual communities, or what I call online communities, happen when people come together with sufficient human feeling to form genuine personal relationships in cyberspace. And that's really what we're getting at here, is how people build their own ethos, evaluate the ethos of others, and shape the ethos of entire communities. Why does that matter? Because this is where most of us live today. And as more of us regularly participate in online communities and educate the next generation of online denizens, we need strategies for developing our own ethos, evaluating the ethos of those we encounter online, and contributing to the collective ethos of the communities to which we belong. Thanks.
All right, Quinn, thank you so much for that tour through Ethos Land and to excite the MetaFilterites in here. For that, can we get another jug of water up here? Maybe probably one. That's good. And so he picked up on that serious business happens in silly communities, and now we are going to take a detour into the silly portion of this talk. There we go.
You sat through me, and now Matt's going to make you laugh.
Thank you so much. All right. Matt's going to change his technology and break things. And there we go. Okay, so Paula Deen and I are going to talk to you today about Kairos and the meme. If neither of those words make sense to you yet, it doesn't matter. They will. Stick around. We'll be right back. So this is a portion of my dissertation.
Cue it.
This is what I wanted. Here we go. In the club now.
I just wanted to set you up. I'm so
thank you. That's perfect. I probably wouldn't have gone with Lady Gaga, but that's okay. I'm a rhetorician who internets. Golfers golf, shooters shoot. I internet. I'm an interneter. So for most people, this picture here is a choice between what to do. For me, this is my everyday life and a dissertation. So I'm the, I guess, the person on the right there looking at dinosaurs and cakes. And so this is, I mean, most of you are probably familiar with meme culture, but we're going to take a really quick tour through it. It's heavily contextual, and it's intertextual and participatory, and it turns out thousands of spin-offs, parodies, and remixes with amazing speed in response to pop culture and world events. It's no secret that there's far more online content competing for far less attention than ever before, and that ever-shifting Sauron's eye of the cultural zeitgeist, which may be the most obnoxious thing I've ever said, can't seem to fixate on anything long enough for a sustained inquiry. So that makes it incredibly difficult to produce academic scholarship or even just creative content professionals to keep up with what's being produced, consumed, remixed, and forgotten. On the subject of forgetting, we're all probably familiar with memes that have overstayed their welcome, that have grown stale in a hurry, or that we come to late. If any of you are, I think now, you have to double check, but there may be a shit South Byers say, which is just rehashing. I mean, we're beating that dead horse far into the ground. We just send it to the glue factory. It's done. But things like that that we all sort of come to late, or we find late, or your mom sends you on Facebook 2 months after it sort of happened. So it's helpful to have a framework for understanding the window for currency and relevance in this world. How do we sort of assess when things have passed their prime and expired? And so as something of a lingua franca for internet culture, memes can provide useful research opportunities to explore how niche communication in these online communities, like Quinn talked about, serves two primary functions of rhetoric, as defined by rhetorician David Zarefsky, as building community and inspiring people to achieve collective goals. Now, more often than not, those collective goals are, ha ha ha, cats. But also, sometimes they can be for meme-heavy internet communities like 4chan or Reddit, can be spurned into action for incredible social good and lots of social chaos. So it's not all silly. Sometimes it's serious, but the serious and the silly all kind of eat each other like meme Ouroboros. These actions are culturally dependent on lining up the right elements of finding the relevant conversation and purpose to inspire collective action. Otherwise, no one's going to really care at all. So enter Kairos, the subject of my talk. It's a Greek word that roughly translates as the right or opportune moment for action. The Greeks had two concepts of time, chronos, which was sort of this quantitative linear passage of time that we could measure, and then kairos, this indefinable qualitative measure of opportunity that you can sense but rarely measure. Nietzsche, the editor of the Daily What, gave a talk on Friday where he sort of talked about it as a blend of intuition and history, which I think is a really great kind of way of describing it. We're going to get back to that in a little bit, too. But he was just depicted as a god, the happy son of Zeus, as you can see here on the left, with a prominent forelock on his otherwise bald head. Here's a hipster version. The idea was that Kairos, representing the opportune moment for action, could be seized by his forelock when he arrives, just grab him by the hair there. But he had a bald head, so once he passed, you were just gasping at a bald head, and you can't grab. So you have to sort of anticipate it as it comes, because once it's gone, he's gone. And we've all experienced this feeling of thinking of a perfect joke or a comeback, but missing the chance to use it, and then painfully realizing it's too late and the conversation has moved on. And the perfect way to sort of segue for this, for you Seinfeld fans, is George Costanza and the Jerk Store. So if you aren't familiar, you should be, by the way, shame on you. George is working for the New York Yankees. He has he's in a business meeting, and he's just scarfing down shrimp as much as he can, and his coworker observes, "You know, George, the ocean called, they're running out of shrimp." and he is embarrassed and he has nothing. But then much later on that day, or maybe even the next day, he comes up with what he thinks is the perfect comeback, which is, oh yeah, the jerk store called, they're running out of you, which is all right itself. But he thinks this is the appropriate thing, and oh man, I'm really going to send him up with this. And so he comes to work the next day, tries to set up it again, finds out his coworker has gone to Cleveland for the day, so he flies to Cleveland, sets up a business meeting to throw some bullshit tire day at Yankee Stadium, just so he can recreate the scene again, to have that chance to grab that forelock again, to really make an impression. And
let's see how many I can fit in my mouth. You know, George, the ocean called. They're running out of shrimp. Oh, yeah, Riley? Well, the jerk store called. They're running out of you. What's the difference? You're their all-time bestseller.
And of course, in the attempt to reappropriate that moment, he's made out to be the buffoon. And in a moment of desperation, before that clip cuts off, he says, oh yeah, well, I had sex with your wife. And then they find out his wife was in a coma. So he goes through these great pains to try and recreate this. And obviously, it's a huge fail for him. And it's a failure of not recognizing that the rhetorical situation he's involved in, the context, has shifted. And he can't just go back and recreate things. Only Cher can turn back time. So Kairos has been something of a sticky wicket in rhetorical studies for the last few decades. In 1968, a rhetorician named Lloyd Bitzer published The Rhetorical Situation, and this is sort of our first concrete introduction to it, and it argued that a situation exists that requires someone to act. So the rhetorical situation, and there's an exigence, I say, I have to do something, and then I have the right or appropriate response. For example, you're involved in the context of listening to me talk now in this session, and you may feel compelled to respond on Twitter with, boo rhetoric, bring back memes. And you're responding to what we call the exigence, which is this urgency or this problem that you need addressing, that you feel like there is a right or appropriate moment to do. And that sort of stuck around for about 5 years unchallenged, and then in 1973, Richard Vatz challenged this model, arguing instead that there's an ongoing context that we are compelled to define so we can make sense of our own communication. That is, all of these responses create the rhetorical situation rather than in response to it, and so it sort of messes up that system. He was less popular in rhetorical studies over the last 30 years for that. And then we fast forward to internet time, and so we get a sense of, where are we here? We get a sense of, in 2005, a researcher called Jenny Edbauer-Rice, who puts forth this ecological model where everything is sort of tangled together. So in the Bitzer model, there's a situation, you respond to it, and then something else happens. In the Vatz model, maybe Quinn is checking his Twitter feed to see how you all responded, and he's stabbing me in the leg saying, move on, it's time to go back to the memes, or something. And in this model, then it's a constant give and take of response and feedback. And so this is sort of a more appropriate one for what we're dealing with today. So to look at an example for how this plays out, some of you are preparing. I want to take us back to a year ago today. What happens when you're a 13-year-old girl who dreams of being the next pop star? Your parents pay $2,000 to an LA company called Arc Music Factory. You then pick up a list from a kitschy pop songs that you didn't write, record a video you didn't plan, and then get to see yourself on YouTube, where you're probably joined the ranks of ignored amateur musicians. 7 a.m. waking up in the morning, gotta be fresh, gotta go downstairs, gotta have my bowl, gotta have cereal, seeing everything, the time
how
is going,
shaking
on and on, everybody's rushing, gotta get down to the bus stop, gotta catch my bus, I see my friends, kicking in the front seat, sitting in the back seat. Gotta make my mind up. Which seat can I take? Oh, you wanted the second part. Ah, oh, son of a. I had to research that for a year, so I've sat through it enough. But if you're Rebecca Black and your parents do this for you, you're ignored and you mostly think this is going to be a fun thing for you to do. You turn into a viral video sensation for all the wrong reasons and become the subject of untold amounts of ridicule and attention from internet culture communities and the guilty people in this room right now, music journalists, and seemingly anyone with access to the web. So that's all I'll play for you on that one. So how did she go from anonymous teenager to having what many are calling literally the worst song of all time? On February 10th, this is last year, her video was uploaded by Arc Music Factory to YouTube, scoring only a few thousand hits within the first few weeks. Respectable, but not a hit. On March 11th, that's yesterday, a year ago, it was uploaded by the popular internet culture blog The Daily What, with a voice crack, the same day as the 8.9 magnitude earthquake struck Japan, so twin disasters in the same day. 6 days later, on 3/17, it had 10 million views on YouTube and cracked the top 100 on iTunes. On the day, on 3/18, Rebecca appeared on ABC's Good Morning America to discuss her sudden fame and the rampant negative criticisms that came with it, which compared some to cyberbullying, and she also gave an acoustic performance on Friday. 2 days later, on 3/20, it was up to 26 million views. On 3/22, she performed live on The Tonight Show. On 3/30, her video passed Justin Bieber's Baby for a total number of dislikes ever received on YouTube, making it YouTube's most hated video of all time. And then on April 6th, it hit 86 million views and has been climbing ever since and was the most watched viral video of 2011. And it's all your fault. So she certainly achieved internet fame, though it's not exactly the way she wanted to. And we'll look at some of these criticisms now and rehash them. On March 14th, Billboard.com, this is when it had 2 million views, wrote, "Black's video for Friday is one of those rare occurrences where even the most seasoned critics of internet culture don't know where to begin." Salon.com likened the song to an effective horror show, while CNN inquires, "Do you think Rebecca Black hates Fridays now?" Time suggests that the video is a joke, whether that's how it was intended or not. And Robot Celeb posits that it's being laughed at by the whole world. On the other hand, OK says that it's very, very catchy. Thanks, OK. You will find yourself singing it in the shower, even if you don't want to. And the Daily Edge sums up her rise to fame neatly, saying, "Rather than the usual positive feedback that tends to characterize such virals, the reason why Black's song is being shared so much is not because it's brilliant, but rather because it's almost universally accepted as being utterly dreadful." How do I do this? There you go. Ah, here we are. Beautiful. The near universal rejection spawned a number of user-generated content responses, as well in the form of parodies, mashups, remixes, and memes, so we see how this rhetorical situation is developing and evolving throughout her descent into internet celebrity. So rhetoricians argue that there isn't just a response, but rather the fitting or appropriate response, which changes based on the situation and constraints of the environment. So in the context of internet culture, then, the appropriate response that fits the situation is the accurate mashup, remix, or intertextual reference that best captures the spirit of the cultural environment into which each piece of content enters. Some mashups succeed and go viral, while others languish in the elephant's graveyard of failed memetic uploads. So image macros often rely on intertextual references to other pop culture phenomenon for them to get buy-in from the communities. If you don't know any of these references, it may not have the same effect on you, and you might just pass something along because other people are laughing. A number of terrific GIFs get captured, edited, and spread. I'm particularly fond of top right. And the GIF is experiencing its own renaissance as a sort of form of discourse online that we could talk about in ad infinitum later on. And thousands of parody videos, like this Bob Dylan cover.
It's Friday, Friday, gotta get down on Friday. Everybody's looking forward to the weekend.
All right. After all of these represent, to varying degrees of chirotic success, a rhetorical response to the Rebecca Black exigence. But who or what created that exigence in the first place? A March 20 article on TechCrunch offers a popular interpretation of the exigence, saying, "So why all the media attention? In part because Justin Bieber and Rebecca Black are two sides of the same coin. Same internet fame coin. Black is like the anti-Justin Bieber. Her Friday video has all the trappings of pop star gloss while with none of the talent. Bieber, on the other hand, had the talent and enthralled fans with that despite the rawness of his homemade YouTube music videos, which he posted before putting out a more polished album and becoming the online and mainstream fame tornado that he is today." So is Black responding to her own situation, her own rhetorical situation, or is she creating it? Or is she doing something that kind of comes along? To her credit, she showed remarkable sort of flexibility in this. She could have just disappeared and said, I'm getting bullied, and then left and never done anything else. But she came out, she was an advocate for cyberbullying, and she kind of came back and said, resilient, or maybe, I'm going to be a star no matter what, and came back out and shifted the dialogue about her. Yes, her song is terrible, but then it became this ironic terrible, and then people started shifting away from her, going, she's just a kid, let's not bully her like this. This is taking us to a dark place we don't want to be as an internet. And maybe she just got lucky, but she capitalized on it as a co-constructor of her own rhetorical situation to not let other people dictate what was going to happen to her, and that's why we're talking about it a year later today, albeit on a Monday. So we're speaking about the ways in which rhetorical processes operate now within a viral economy, and this ecological layered interpretation is echoed by critics of internet culture as well. As Death and Taxes magazine writes, by and large, internet meme culture has turned into the punchline of the joke that it's simultaneously laughing at. The joke has turned dark, inward, and the more people get thrown into said joke, the worse it becomes, and the angrier the machine gets, and the more food it wants. So we're all co-constructing the same process of give us things to make fun of, and then we'll make fun of it, giving you more things to give us to make fun of, and it never stops. So in other words, the exigence for memes and viral media is co-constructed by creators and consumers of internet culture alike. No one's just responsible. No one is free of guilt. So internet culture appropriates or interprets appropriate not as good or truthful in the classical sense, but rather what will go viral and capture attention. And so we can move away from these kinds of things, but I think what we've shown today, Monday, that there is a serious use of rhetoric for the classical sense in the modern web today. And you can apply it in a lot of different situations. We can appreciate memes and rhetoric for impacting our culture in significant ways, and whether that's lolling or wincing or compelling the geeks, slacktivists, and neckbeards of the world to unite and participate in the wild range of serious issues we face. And we can see that with some other examples, like protests nationwide over physical privacy at the airport, or protests in Wisconsin over unions, or the Arab Spring, or subversive anti-censorship memes in China. This is a great thing for you all to Google later. The Song of the Grass Mud Horse. Basically, Chinese bloggers kept on getting their sites shut down because they would use words like oppression. And the government would say, no. And so then they started using words like harmony, using it ironically. And the government said, we know what you're doing. And so these bloggers then said, how about the word in Mandarin for grass mud horse, which, I think I get this right, is actually the C word in Mandarin. And so it became this whole thing where they're fighting oppression, they're fighting things. And so this became this, like, weird subculture of people trying to respond here and there with other things. Grass mud horse, check it out. Or, of course, we could sit here and beat the Coney story to death, but fortunately the internet's already done it for us. Instead, I'll look quickly at the last thing here before we conclude. A good example of how meme culture appropriates something and makes it more important than what it is, gives people an entry for it. So Occupy Wall Street started out, and people sort of started taking notice of it. And then this whole We Are the 99% movement came out with the website that came with it so people could upload their stories. Then the backlash to that came with hardworking, honest Americans who are the 53% then and criticized the 99% for bitching about jobs when I have one too. And from that, then people saw this as a huge silliness and said, all right, we're going to occupy Sesame Street, and we're going to make it silly back to where we go. So it goes from serious to silly and silly to serious, but it constantly powers forward and looks at this rhetorical situation. And then when things like the pepper spraying cop incident at UC Berkeley, I want to say, maybe?
Davis.
Well, excuse me, room full of people who know better than me. This came out, and people were sort of outraged because these are peaceful protesters sitting down and getting just doused in pepper spray. And so they took the casually pepper-spraying cop meme and started photoshopping it as a metaphor for the police state running rampant and roughshod over free speech, which was a delightful way of sort of participating in this rhetorical situation at that time that it was going on. And then, of course, from that, Megyn Kelly of Fox News said, you know, reacting to this reaction, said, pepper spray, it's a food product, essentially, which then got memeified to things like pizza, it's vegetables, essentially, which tied into the whole thing in Congress of classifying pizza as vegetables, and then some more serious things as well as they go. So we see how memes impact the media and our culture by drawing from our common experiences and tropes, and I think we've shown here today that a deeper understanding of rhetorical studies, whether demagoguery or ethos or kairos, can provide a useful lens for understanding the motivations of online communities and users. Thank you. We have a little time left for questions. The gifts sort of ate up a lot. We'd love to hear from you. Yes, sir.
You have to face the back.
Yeah, you have to face the back. Turn away from us.
There's been a lot of talk this year about, and last year to a certain extent, about anonymity and the role, whether it's good or bad. And I'm wondering how much anonymity plays into the three elements that you guys have brought up today.
Quinn, you want to start that one?
Sure. I think it plays a huge role when you start talking about ethos and identity issues, whether it's anonymity or pseudonymity. Online communities have long had a complicated history with that. There have been some fantastic presentations here at South by Southwest specifically focused on whether or not anonymity is killing the web and what that's doing to us as a culture. I think that oftentimes, though, we have overblown the concerns about anonymity, and what we're really seeing is that identity is much more persistent online than we've previously thought. It used to be that, oh, you can go on and do anything. Well, my study, for instance, and several others have shown that identity within online communities, you do build a reputation. You do build kind of a credibility or an ethos over time within that community. Whether or not you choose to transfer that to another community is up to you, and that's where it becomes really fascinating, I think, where identity becomes malleable on the borderlines between different communities. So if I use my Twitter handle and I become known by that, then when I sign up for other new services, now I'm more likely, if I want to, carry my ethos into that online community, I can use the same username or the same handle in new communities. Or if I want to say, nope, that's my professional self and this is my fun, casual self, I'm going to have two different online identities there. I mean, there's so much work to be done there, but I think you're absolutely right that for me, the most important questions of conversation and discourse online always come back to identity.
Thanks,
anybody
guys.
Else want to add to that?
No, that's no. You. I'm not going to sound nearly that eloquent. I'm just going to play GIFs. That's my go-to. Go ahead, sorry.
I got into a discussion with a friend the other day about the idea of quality versus quantity in online discourse. And basically what it came down to was, one position was it's like the breadth of all ideas that can be captured in a huge quantity of discourse ultimately outweighs even the smallest amount of quality discourse. And we got into some disagreement about that. And I guess I just wanted to know if you guys had an opinion on whether quality or quantity was more important.
So the mountain of crap is better than the rock of
right,
gold?
Because ultimately you convey so many ideas in the mountain of crap that, you know, it covers the breadth of all the possibilities, whereas with quality, maybe you focus on one or two ideas in depth with rigorousness, but you end up missing out on so much.
So this is like the multiverse theory of good content?
Yeah, exactly, sort of.
That I don't have to come up with it, I don't have to find it. It exists somewhere, probably?
Pretty much.
That's an interesting challenge, because I think for that kind of purpose, especially for when we talk about buying in for specific users to connect to the right audiences, that we can't let everyone just kind of find it on their own, because they won't, because it is a mountain, and you have a lot to kind of go through, and it's a multiverse, if you like. And so I think the idea that rhetoric can kind of bring of identifying, you know, like through sense and intuition and history, you're going to enjoy this content. It's not going to be from this great mountain, but I'm going to mine it out for you and then pass it off. I think that's where the role of not necessarily creators, because they're kind of adding onto the mountain, but curators, I think that's where their primary role comes in, is mining out that mountain for you. Whether or not, there's certainly a mountain of crap. Let's not bandy about that. But I don't know that having a mountain of crap outweighs a small amount of quality.
I think we're forgetting about the mountain of crap of offline discourse, right? People say, well, I hate Twitter because it's just everybody talking about what they had for lunch, right? That's like the stereotype. And I say, oh, really? Do you love talking about what the weather's like today in the hallway with your coworkers? Is that great discourse? No, I mean, all of us experience, nonsensical or pointless communication, the crap, so to speak, all day long in our real lives. The only difference is that we're typing it instead of saying it in online communities, and it's archived.
And it's searchable.
Right? And it's searchable, yeah. Right? Which does obviously add some new dimensions to it. I'm not trying to oversimplify, but if I've got to choose, right, I'll put up with the mountain of crap, and I'll learn to filter and search and curate and whatever strategies you want to talk about in order to get to that really great stuff, in the same way that I'm willing to put up with lots and lots of phatic or pointless discourse in my real life in order to have those few amazing, awesome conversations with real people.
Yeah. And I think that for Reddit, that's, in my comparison between Reddit and Real Clear Politics, Real Clear Politics is much more of the golden nugget sort of strategy, whereas Reddit is more of, you're going to get 10 links on the front page about, you know, something absurd. And That's part of what's great about the messy public discourse, the messy, you know, people saying stupid things, but then good stuff happens. And so I think that that's a good way to avoid demagoguery, is to allow people to find their own nuggets in there.
So it seems like you're saying that both are necessary to a certain degree, but the quality comes from having these huge mountains of crap ideas, and ultimately that gets filtered down into something resembling a quality idea.
Yeah.
We're buttoned up against the end here, but you can certainly send us anything, but we have time for one more, I guess, and then we'll make sure we get a chance to talk to both of you. So go ahead.
This might be a long question.
We'll answer it very quickly.
So if anyone here, and either any of you guys attended the session on narcissism and how it affects and the psychology of narcissism and how it feels down into blogging, and if you watched like this presentation or the movie last night, We Are Legion, about Anonymous, there's a good amount of aspect that goes on in that the people who post online are actively searching for followers, and that there's a good amount of narcissism in the idea of actually people actually flocking to the site with which that will actually have the people who are open to following them, right, which feeds directly into the Real Clear Politics versus Reddit phenomenon. HP actually did a study of this about 3 weeks ago that actually predicted the popularity of articles and tweets based upon their topicality related to the audience likely to be listening to them. And so the question is the problem between Reddit and Real Clear Politics in terms of demagoguery, or is it not demagoguery in and of itself? Because people are actually flocking to where their readers are, and they don't actually know that they're demagogues. They actually believe that they're open and neutral and unbiased, and it's because they can't actually see it, because all they hear and all they talk about are to people who have the same ideals as them.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Sorry, that was dramatic oversimplification, and Jeff can probably answer this better than I can. But again, not to keep beating this horse, but this happens offline too, right? We're not witnessing completely new phenomena, and I agree with you. I think that's definitely happening. I mean, the Huffington Post has perfected the art of tuning its headlines and link titles, right, to ensure maximum tweetability. And that's just one tiny example. But I think the fact that people don't recognize demagogues does not mean that they're not that people aren't demagogues, if that makes sense, right? Just because my audience doesn't know I'm a demagogue doesn't mean I'm not one. That's my take on it.
That's why it's so important to not to be wary when people say I'm being unbiased, or to be wary when people try to look like they're being unbiased, because the act of trying to look unbiased is just absurd, and because it's impossible. So that's good point.
Next year's panel.
The easiest thing we can do in the 30 seconds we have left is figure out exactly what the Buddha would think about demagoguery on Real Clear Politics, but I would leave it at that with the unanswerable question, and encourage you to contact us if you want to continue this discourse. But otherwise, thank you all for coming so much, and enjoy the rest of the panels.